Okay, so today's sutta, the Majjhima 7, the Wattupama Sutta, discourse on the simile of the cloth, being of course the inspiration for Jack Kornfield's classic After the Ecstasy, The Laundry. And one of those very simple and timeless similes which the Buddha actually used often, like the kind of the similes of the Ganges River or the Himalaya or whatever it is, but the simile of the cloth being one of the classic similes, and of course in cloth has been one of the kind of outstanding products of India for such a long time, and the quality of the cloth is still superb. And I know when Gandhi traveled, because the cloth industry was one of the major industries and things that Gandhi had to deal with. And then when Gandhi traveled to England, he felt that the British needed special trade concessions from the Indians because their cloth industry was so far behind the Indian. So this being a special speciality for a long period of time. And this sutta has three full Chinese parallel versions, according to Venerable Nalalio, two of which occur in the Madhyama Agama, one in the Ekotara Agama, and the third parallel is an individual translation. The individual translation was made by an unknown translator during the period 317 to 420 AD. The Madhyama Agama version has a title which translates as Sutta on the Brahman Practicing Water Purification. And the individual translation has the title on the Brahman speculating about water purification. And even in the Pali versions, there's different titles. The Burmese edition has cloth, the cloth sutta, and the Thai and Sinhalese editions have the simile of the cloth. The commentary also refers to it as the cloth sutta. So on and so forth. So the titles of suttas is actually quite random, being just something which has been assigned by some editor to some period of time, so it's not uncommon to find different titles for the same sutta. So in addition to those three full Chinese parallels, there's also two partial parallels for the final section of the Wattupama Sutta about the ritual bathing in a river. Has two parallels in both versions of the Samyukta Agama, which exist in Chinese translation. So a little difference that Analia notes before just going on to the sutra itself. According to the Madhyama Agama version and the individual translation, this discourse took place immediately after the Buddha's enlightenment. So that being quite a different setting. Analia says this suggestion is not convincing, since for this discourse to take place right after the Buddha's awakening, it would have been before his departure to Varanasi, and therefore before his five early followers became his first monk disciples. In view of this, it would be difficult to account for the presence of monks as listening to the present discourse, a circumstance mentioned in both these Chinese versions. So the discourses say they're set immediately after the awakening, but then they go on to include monks in the audience within the sutta, so that doesn't really make sense. Okay, so there seems to be some kind of redaction problem or textual problem there. That's what I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Savatthi at Jeta's Grove in Atapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus," "Bhante," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Because suppose a cloth were pure and bright, and a dye dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink, it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, an unhappy destination a destination may be expected. So of course, the unhappy destinations being the destination in the three planes of rebirth, in the hell realms, animal realm, and the hungry ghost realm. And the happy destination being either a human rebirth or a rebirth in the heavenly realms. And this is something that's an interesting little point to bear about the nature of karma, is that in Buddhism, rebirth in the human realm is always as a result of good karma. Yeah? So sometimes some people like to say that if you're born, you know, with a deformity, or you're born ill or something like that, then this is the result of your bad karma. Or if you're born poor or something like that, that's because of your bad karma. Whereas in fact, the very fact that you're born a human at all means that you're born because of your good karma. Otherwise you wouldn't have made it. Yeah? So, what bhikkhus are the imperfections that defile the mind? So the imperfections, the Pali for the imperfections that defile the mind, of course, defile the mind, is the cittassa upakilesa. And Bhikkhu Bodhi comments on that. The word upakilesa is sometimes used in the sense of blemishes or imperfections of meditative concentration, as in the Upakilesa Sutta, Majjhima 128, or sometimes in the sense of the blemishes or perfections of insight, described in the Visuddhi Magga, and sometimes to signify the minor defilements that arise from the three unwholesome roots, greed, hatred, and delusion, either as their modes or their offshoots. Here it is used in this third sense, but to maintain the connection with the first two uses, it has been translated by the phrase imperfections that defile the mind. So, three uses of upakilesa. So of course, we have the very common word kilesa, we have for general word for defilements. Kilesa is not actually used all that commonly in the suttas as such. It is used, but it's not one of the really standard words, but became very standard later on. Upakilesa, upa having the meaning of, here having the meaning of kind of little or minor or,
Sorry, they're saying that these are
upakilesas. Upakilesas, yeah. So these are upakilesas.
And is that different from the taints, you know, in
asavas, yeah.
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 Those were heavier.
But more fundamental, perhaps.
More fundamental.
Yeah, in a sense, upakilesas, like in meditation, upakilesas are like somebody who's developing samadhi, and maybe they get a nimitta, and then they're not quite able to purify the nimitta or something like that, and this is called like the upakilesas. So it has that sense, which isn't an absolute sense, but it's a general feeling about it, that it's more the subtle kind of remnant defilements rather than being the real kind of wellsprings of defilement. And the same in the process of insight, and in do you want to get the Visuddhi Magga? In the Visuddhi Magga has the, since our reading from the Visuddhi Magga was so popular last week, should maybe get something there, has the Vipassana Upakilesa in the Visuddhi Magga, which is an important category to know something about, or important passage to know something about, because it's extremely influential in modern meditation discourse, even though of course as Bhikkhu Bodhi notes, it doesn't have a canonical precedent, but still is imperfections very, very common in meditation discourse. So I might just read through that briefly. So this is in chapter 20 of the Visuddhi Magga, chapter dealing with Magga Magga Jnana, what is the path and what is not the path. So notice that if you have a look in the book, we're that much towards the end, okay? And we've done this much of the book is on, there we're going.
Only a tiny bit on Sila.
Not much on Sila. So this is the idea of the introduction. Right. This much is the Sila section. This much is the concentration is about here. Okay, so that's the Sila section there. This is the Samadhi section, so about two or three times as long on Samadhi. And then from here is the Wisdom section, so about similar length to the Samadhi section, maybe a bit longer. So the point of that is that we've already gone a long, long way along the path. This is not talking about something which is really at the beginning. So this is again the point that making that these are talking about things that are very refined, very subtle. Now when he's a beginner of insight with this tender insight, okay, taruna, vipassana, like baby vipassana, 10 perfections of insight arise in him. For imperfections of insight do not arise either in a noble disciple who has reached penetration of the truths or in persons without virtue, neglectful of the meditation subject and idlers. Okay? So either of those two, either if you're enlightened, you don't get them because you've already gone beyond them, and if you're not practicing properly, you don't get them either because your defilements are still too coarse. And they only arise in a clansman who keeps to the right course, devotes himself continuously to his meditation subject, and is a beginner of insight. But what are these 10 imperfections? They are, 1, illumination. Light appears. 2, knowledge. Okay, so knowledge, jnana, is an imperfection of insight. Rapturous happiness. 4, tranquility. 5, bliss. 6, resolution. Okay, so you become completely committed to your meditation. You won't give up. Exertion. Okay, it's just you've got this energy here. You just keep on going. Assurance. Just seeing what the Pali of that is. Ah, okay, upatthana, assurance. This is. We'll talk about that in a minute. That's number 8. Equanimity, upekha, whatever happens. And attachment is the last one. Now, the interesting thing about this particular category. Okay, I'll just read through a little bit through each of these ones according to the stories it has here. Herein, illumination is illumination due to insight, which is an important thing to notice. The first thing about this category is it's vipassana upakilesis, so it's due to vipassana. Okay, these things always arise in the course of doing vipassana meditation, not in the course of doing samatha meditation. So this is not talking about lights and bliss and everything that arises in samatha meditation, which is of course what you're trying to achieve, but it's stuff which is arising in vipassana meditation. When it arises, the meditator thinks, such illumination never arose in me before. I have surely reached the path, reached the fruit, and he takes what is not the path to be the path, and what is not fruition to be fruition, remembering that that's the title of the chapter that we're in, what is the path and what is not the path. When what he takes what is not the path to be the path and what is not the fruit to be the fruit, the course of his insight is interrupted. He enjoys his own basic meditation subjects and just sits enjoying the illumination. And the story, it illustrates how this varies. Two elders, it seems, were sitting inside a room with a double wall in the Chittalapabbata monastery. It was the opposita of the dark of the moon that day. All of the directions were covered by a blanket of cloud, and at night the four-factored gloom prevailed. Then one elder said, see, they're so intent on systematizing everything, they've even counted how many factors the gloom has. Then one elder said, Venerable Sir, the flowers of the five colors on the lion table on the shrine terrace are visible to me now. The other said, What you say is nothing wonderful to me, friend. Actually, the fishes and turtles in the ocean a league away are visible to me now. So, because the defilements suppressed by the attainments do not manifest, he thinks, I am an arahant. And here is one story. One day, this monk was sitting in his kuti and he thought, has our teacher, the elder Mahanaga, brought his work of asceticism to his conclusion or not? He saw that he was still an ordinary man and he knew that if he did not go to him, he would die an ordinary person. He rose up into the air with supernormal power and sat down and alighted near the elder who was sitting in his daytime quarters. He paid homage to him and sat down to one side. The elder asked the question, "Why have you come unexpectedly, my friend?" He said, "I've come to ask a question, venerable sir." And he said, "Ask, friend, if we know, we shall answer." Then he asked 1,000 questions. The elder answered without hesitation to each question. Then the monk said, "Your knowledge is very keen, venerable sir. When was this state attained by you?" He replied, 60 years ago, friend." "Do you practice concentration, venerable sir?" "That is not difficult, friend." "Then make an elephant, venerable sir." The elder made an elephant, all white. "Now, venerable sir, make that elephant come straight at you with his ears outstretched, his tail extended, putting his trunk in the mouth and making a horrible trumpeting sound." The elder did so. When he saw the frightful aspect of the rapidly approaching elephant, he sprang up and wanted to run away. So the elder, with his defilements destroyed, put out his hand, and catching him by the hem of his robe, said, "Venerable sir, is there any fear in one whose defilements are destroyed?" Then he recognized that he was still an ordinary man. He fell at the other's feet and said, "Help me, my friend Dhammadina." Then he expounded a meditation object, went onto the walking path, and with the third footstep, he reached arahantship.
Wow.
After 60 years. So that's not too bad, is it? So, anyway, so this is the illumination. Knowledge is knowledge due to insight. There, as he is investigating Nama Rupa, he has knowledge that is unerring, keen, incisive, and very sharp. This arises in him like a lightning flash. Rapturous happiness is happiness due to insight. 5 kinds of rapture arise in him, filling his whole body. Tranquility is tranquility due to insight. When he's sitting, he has no fatigue or heaviness or rigidity. His body is very tranquil and blissful. Bliss is bliss due to insight. Resolution is faith, for strong faith arises in him who, in association with insight, in the form of extreme confidence. Exertion is energy. Assurance, this is the 8th one. I can't remember what the Pali for that is right now. Assurance is mindfulness. Okay, so, it's literally establishment. It must be upatthana, which is mindfulness, just a synonym for mindfulness. For well-established, well-founded mindfulness, which is dug in and immovable as the king of mountains, arises in him in association with insight. Whatever subject he adverts to, consciously reacts to, gives attention to, reviews, appears to him owing to mindfulness, which he descends into, enters into it, just as the other world does to one who has the divine eye. Equanimity is both equanimity about insight and equanimity in adverting. Okay, so equanimity about insight is he has strong equanimity about all formations, all sankharas, and equanimity in adverting the mind. Whatever subject he adverts to, what turns his mind to, this works incisely and sharply as a lightning flash, like a red-hot spear plunged into a basket of leaves. My goodness.
That was mindfulness?
That was equanimity.
Oh, that was equanimity.
Yeah. Well, this looks dangerous. Right. So maybe I should go and see how I... Anyway, there'll be another couple of minutes. At least I'll get to the end of this bit before. We'll just get there. Okay. So... attachment is attachment due to insight, and is the attachment arising in all of those things. So just the basic point about these things is that in all of those cases, the problem, of course, is the attachment to them. Okay, it's not the thing itself, but it's the attachment and misunderstanding of the thing. And this is a passage which is very often quoted, especially by teachers in Mahasi tradition and so on, who like to say, don't, you know, get your bliss and so on, and these are called vipassanu pakilesas in Thai idiom. They often call it vipassanu, just abbreviate it vipassanu, and this is if you get bliss and all of these kinds of things. But of course, remember that that doesn't just include the bliss and rapture, but also includes even knowledge and mindfulness. Anything which you have in your meditation, which you attach to in your vipassana meditation, nothing to do with samatha meditation, in your vipassana meditation, then this is called the vipassanu pakilesas. The other interesting thing about this, which I just mentioned before going to greet our guests, but the whole section is not found in the suttas. What is found in the suttas is another passage which talks about a meditator who gets what they call dhammudhaccha, is the restlessness or excitement about the Dhamma. And What's interesting about that is that in the suttas, where it talks about getting one who gets excitement about the Dhamma, then it says someone who's practicing intent on the higher mind, which means in practice intent on getting jhanas, it's the higher mind. And then when they get this restlessness or excitement about the Dhamma, then they have to settle, tranquilize the mind. They have to do more samatha meditation in order to overcome this. Now, in the commentarial tradition, that Dhammudraccha is identified with the vipassanupakilesas. Okay, so that what's called the restlessness or excitement about the Dhamma becomes said, this is what the vipassanupakilesas are. But whereas the suttas say that the cure for this is doing samatha meditation, then the commentary says the cure for it is doing vipassana meditation. So they give you exactly the opposite cure for the problem. And of course the link between those two things is entirely artificial. This system of vipassanupakilesas being a system developed purely by the commentaries and not being found in the suttas at all. So important to know something about these things because, as I said, they do figure quite strongly in modern meditation discourse, not just in Mahasi technique, also in some of the Thai traditions like Lumpur, what's his name? Ajahn, the one who sort of does
the waving
hands get enlightened. Yeah, one waving hands get enlightened one. Yeah, he talks about it a lot.
Tien.
Oh, yeah, something like that, yeah.
If you're going, can we pick this up next time we meet in the study group?
Sure.
And do that in the Satipatthana Sutta?
Yeah, well, yes, we can. So, Irene, you wanted to ask them all about that?
I think my question is around the role of mindfulness, and I'm just trying to get clear what you're saying, because from my experience, when this is mindfulness in the mind, you can't see the blemishes or the taints, you know. So when the Buddha talked about blemishes in that one sutra, he said, if you know it, it's better. The knowing is mindfulness.
Right.
And with the taints, you know, it was like the first part of the taints was seeing it. But then, you know, just ordinary living, it's like mindfulness is critical to seeing that so that you can abandon it. It's like you have to see suffering before you can abandon it.
Yeah.
So that's the role of mindfulness, both in just momentary and then when it builds up. So it's just, there's not so much effort anymore, it's just arising in the mind.
Very automatic.
So I'm not quite sure then, given that it feels so, you know, such a sort of fundamental part of how I see my mind and what the Buddha is saying and other things, what you're saying about mindfulness.
You mean what the Visuddhimagga was saying about it?
Well, you said that's not the Buddha's teaching, and I'm like, oh, but the Buddha has been saying it in these suttas, even that we've just covered so far, that mindfulness and seeing is a critical part.
Oh, sure, but that's not what I wasn't saying. That bit wasn't the Buddha's teaching, just that the list of the 10 defilements of insight, this is not found in the suttas. And nor is the idea that these things arise at a certain stage in meditation.
Fine.
Yeah.
I mean, it is true that as you go through the different processes, as you go through practice, you see the mind clinging to those different things, and
for sure,
seeing it dissolves.
Yeah, for sure. You know what the essence or the basic thing of what that passage is saying is not problematic at all. You know, it's just saying that stuff happens in your meditation, sometimes really good stuff, which is mistaken and attached to, and then that causes you to stop in your progress, right? Which is fine, but the problem is that category. As such, being not found, the fact that it's not found in the suttas doesn't particularly mean anything, because the suttas don't talk about everything, right? And so it doesn't mean that it's wrong or something like that because it's not found in the suttas. But it does mean that, as a category, as it's the problem I have with it is not so much what it's saying about there, but it's more the way that the category has been taken up and used in modern meditation discourse, where it's often applied in ways which is much more broad than how is meant, obviously implied even in the Visuddhimagga. Like, you know, so any time you experience any bliss in your meditation, oh, don't get attached to it because this will be an obstruction in your practice. Because that's clearly not what the Visuddhimagga is saying, and it's clearly not what the Buddha is saying. So these kinds of ideas are things that I would have problems with. And one of the sources for those ideas is sort of what I think is a misinterpretation of what the Visuddhimagga is intending there.
Okay, so you're saying it's okay to get attached to bliss for a certain amount of time before you let go of it? Or what are you saying exactly?
I'm saying that it's kind of, it's normal. I'm not necessarily saying that it's okay, but saying that it's normal that bliss happens and stuff happens and that you shouldn't be afraid of it.
Okay.
Yeah? And that it kind of normally the letting go of those things happens through its own natural phase rather than necessarily needing any specific prescription. I mean, it reminds me a bit of what I was thinking about. I think I'm not sure if I mentioned it a bit about the whole thing about trauma counseling, which is sort of, I don't know why this analogy occurs to me, but after like the tsunami and stuff, they send all these trauma counselors in to counsel everybody, whereas in fact they've got no evidence at all that it actually does any good, because most people most of the time get over their trauma. 95% of people actually deal with trauma. And what I was just reading today is that actually the most remarkable or the most common and remarkable quality that you actually see when you go in there is resilience. What you actually see is incredible people's incredible ability to actually cope with these things and get over them. And that's really the outstanding feature. And then, of course, 5% or 10% can't. And those are the ones that really need the counselling. But that doesn't become apparent until quite a long time later. So this, again, it's a kind of same dynamic. Yes, there is something which maybe there was a problem, you know. So there's these kind of stories in there about these monks who are having these kind of things. But, you know, maybe it happens once or twice, but then it becomes this kind of paradigm, which becomes, applied far more broadly than it should be or than it has any benefit in being. This is just my feeling about it. Yeah.
Bhante, I think my experience is this instruction that I've had is that it's kind of evil.
Evil?
You know, bliss is evil.
Yeah?
Keep away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and then it's
be afraid. Be very afraid.
You're better off to sit there in agony.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Who's given you that instruction?
Venerable Vivekananda. Huh. One of Upandita's teachers. Huh. So, you know, you're better off to sit there just in pain and have aversion.
Wow, that's heavy. But isn't it all right to be actually attached, isn't it?
Actually good to be attached because you're getting attached to a better state than attached to sensual pleasures, and that can, from what I understand, can take you out of your attachment to the mundane sensual. Sure, yeah. Right, Devakor brings to my mind what the Buddha said when he said why am I afraid of that pleasure which is not sensual pleasure, which he says is the jhanas.
Mm.
When he recalls his sitting under the rose apple tree and he is the first jhana, why am I afraid of that?
Yeah, yeah. So, and the point at which that distinction pivots is the fact that the feelings experiencing jhanas is called the nekama sukha. The wasagga ramana, like the dependent on letting go or dependent on renunciation. So it's actually the jhanas are things which you let go into, is usually how they're described, rather than being things that you actually have to attach to. Yes, there is an attachment to that, but that's something which all of us have anyways. Is the problem? See, it's not as if we don't have attachment to jhanas, and we get the attachment when we do the jhanas. But the attachment to jhanas is an anusaya. It's an underlying tendency to be attached to, you know, exalted states of consciousness. And so it's not something which we get because we've done that. Yeah, it's something which, when we've let go of other attachments, becomes apparent. We can actually see it, and we can actually look at it for the first time. Yeah. So this is the that's the thing, and it's not something which is, you know, as the Buddha said, "Na bhayi tambang," do not be afraid.
Bhante, also the problem comes in is that joy is one of the enlightenment factors.
Exactly. So all of these things are presented in the suttas as being, of course, the positive things. And they are too in the Visuddhimagga. That's not any different. They're always presented in the positive things in Visuddhimagga. Apart from that one little passage where it basically says, you know, watch out, don't get attached to them. And don't take this to be enlightenment. So there's a difference between just liking something and taking it much more, these guys seem to take it much more seriously. They really thought that they were arahants, you know? And that's obviously much more serious than simply having a bit of relishing of that mental state or a bit of liking of it, you know, because that's something you can still reflect on, yeah? When you come out of it, you know, oh, you reflect on that. Why was that blissful? Why was that peaceful? Yeah.
The mind has a tendency to feed, and we feed on all kinds of horrible, junk food, mental, I don't know what to say. No, just garbage. And so, I mean, from what I understand, the rapture is a more of a healthy food for the mind. Mm-hmm. It gets healthier and healthier and healthier. And then, if it has healthier food, then it will have less tendency to be interested in garbage.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it seems like it's really important.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Lifts you out.
Also, in the attachment to other states, it's only some interest in any government at the time.
Yes, yeah, so the complete letting go of the jhanas that's the job of the anagami.
So when we're sakadagamis, we can worry about it then?
When we're anagamis, we're worried about it. Get over it to become arahants.
That's right.
So then, it's also true that you can get stuck there because you get so identified with it. And I think that's what it's speaking to, is that, you know, what I, at least in my experience of hearing what different teachers are saying, they're not saying don't experience it, but just, you know, watch that you don't get identified with it, you know, and that you don't sort of start as, but it's not the whole path. I think that's...
Sure. But that's the line which, you know, shouldn't be crossed, and which I think often is. I don't think it always is, but I think there are teachers who basically say you shouldn't experience them, it's wrong. And then that's the line which is I think a mistake. Yeah.
Do you remember where the passage where the Buddha says not to be afraid of the attachment?
It happens a few times, but it's in the among the Arana Vibhanga Sutta. In the Vibhanga Vagga. 130 something. Okay, I think maybe never mind that one. Fine, we've already just enough for now, but just better keep going the rest of the sutta. So, the imperfections that defile the mind: covetousness, abhijja, and unrighteous greed, visamalobha, is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will, anger, revenge, contempt, a domineering attitude, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, presumption, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence are imperfections that defiles the mind. So this being a list of unwholesome dhammas which are to some degree similar to groups that are found in the preceding suttas and also in some to come as well. Knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. So here pointing to what Dorina mentioned before, that the key there is the knowing of it. Right? If you're knowing these things, is the first thing. So this is a really important part of the Buddha's path, is that you know, Buddhism is completely, you know, opposed to the whole thing of denying and suppressing your unwholesome dhammas. Yeah, so it's not about pretending that you don't have them, yeah? And this is, of course, one problem, and it's sometimes a problem when we kind of feel that we're, we should be something. We're meditators, so we should be holy and pure, or we're monks, so we should be holy and pure, or something like that, and we feel that we shouldn't have these kinds of dhammas. So sometimes there's a tendency to want to pretend or project to others or to ourselves that we are pure, that we don't have these things, and so on. And so very important to be humble about that, to recognize, okay, this is just a defilement, and that's all. Defilements are just defilements, they're not people. It's not your defilement, it's just something that comes into the mind and then goes away from the mind again. So you don't need to identify with it and make a problem out of it, but to recognize that it happens very, very clearly and very, very humbly. So when a bhikkhu has known that these things are imperfections of the mind and has abandoned them, then he acquires perfect confidence in the Buddha. Thus, the Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. He acquires perfect confidence in the Dhamma. Thus, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading to be experienced by the wise for themselves. He acquires perfect confidence in the Sangha. Thus, the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way, that is, the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. This Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. So, the acquiring of perfect confidence in these things, of course, being equivalent to stream entry. And the description of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha here being, again, the standard description that we chant in our evening chanting. Iti piso bhagava arahang sama sambuddho. And most of the terms here are fairly straightforward. The only ones which I would just comment on here is some of the terms just describing the Dhamma, and we have the phrase sandittiko akaliko, visible, which Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated as visible here and now, sandittiko, and immediately effective, akaliko. So I think they're probably quite good renderings or translations of these things. These are somewhat controversial because again, akalika has become understood in several different ways. One way that it's been interpreted according to the commentarial system of mind moments, and it's understood that the magga citta, the one mind moment of the path, is followed without a gap by the mind moment of the fruit. And this is what akalika means, timeless means. So this being obviously an extremely contrived explanation of that. And then others say that timeless means that the Dhamma doesn't have any temporal dimension. And it's specifically applied in the context of dependent origination, so that dependent origination is not the unfolding of a sequence of conditions in time, but is a like a vertical slice which reveals the inner structure of every moment. And so this is like a structural sense of causality, so that instead of we thinking like, you know, avijja, sankhara, and vijnana and so on as being stretched out in time, but according to this interpretation, it's not like that. They're all kind of piled on top of one another and they all occur in one moment. And this is what timeless means. This is another interpretation of what timeless means, because this phrase timeless is actually applied to dependent origination in some places. So other people think that timeless means it's not another interpretation that's been advanced is opposition to yavakalika. Yavakalika being a word which means temporary, as in like goods which are hired out for a day and then you have to get them back. Okay, So the Dhamma is not like that. It's not something which you get the benefit of, it lasts for a bit of time, then you have to sort of give it back. It doesn't get worn out by usage. Okay, so this is another meaning of akalika, and so on and so forth. So all of these kind of interpretations which have been advanced for akalika, and some of them, of course, very good. I mean, another meaning is that the Dhamma doesn't change in the different periods of time. So the Dhamma at the time of the Buddha is the same as the Dhamma today, or the same in the Dhamma time of past and future Buddhas and so on. It's another meaning which sometimes you hear for akalika. And so all of these things are very nice, that's fine, right? But I get a little bit frustrated sometimes when commentators come along and say, oh yes, it means this and it means that and it means the other. And I'm like, well, what does it mean actually? Because sometimes words are used in that sense. They're used just to mean, you know, it's just used like in a way to evoke, you know, things, and it can have a very broad variety of meanings, and you know, you can look at it from many different perspectives. Sometimes that's the case, sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes words are meant in a more specific sense, and then I'm left wondering about what is that actual specific sense and what does it mean. And so I did a bit of research on that point, and what it seems that this phrase means is that first thing to note is it comes together with sandittiko and akalika, and in many places these occur together in a close conjunction, sandittikam akalikam. So when words are used in that way in a Pali idiom, usually means that they're synonyms. Okay, so they're just used, they're basically have the same meaning, and a very common Pali idiom. And there's one particular passage where it says swakkhatam brahmacharyam sandittikam akalikam yata amogha pabaja apamattasa sikato. This holy life, okay, is well expounded. Apparently, sandittika and akalika, where the going forth is not free of benefit for one who is diligent in training. And so there it seems to have the idea that when you're really practicing the Dhamma, yeah, someone who's really practicing the Dhamma can actually experience the benefits of it. So it's the practice of brahmacharya instead of just the Dhamma in general, but it's the brahmacharya. So the actual spiritual life is something which has results which can be experienced, and you can experience here and now. The other thing which is useful in understanding this is there's particular dialogue which occurs a few times in the suttas, and also the same thing occurs in the Jaina suttas, where the Buddha is challenged, and the Buddha says, someone comes up to the Buddha and says, you know, you're teaching the Dhamma, you're teaching a Dhamma which is teaching the benefit which is samparayika and neglecting what is sandittika. Okay, in other words, samparayika meaning pertaining to future lives. Okay, in other words, the accusation is, you're teaching a Dhamma which, you know, is going to get you to heaven, right? And you're neglecting being happy here and now. And on the Buddha's response, of course, is, to the contrary, I'm teaching a Dhamma which is neglecting what is for the future for the sake of what is here and now, sandittika. Yeah? And so the Dhamma I'm teaching is the Dhamma to be realized here and now. And that kind of discourse happens a few times in the suttas, and in the Pali it uses sandittika there. And interestingly enough, when the same discourse happens in the Jain sutras, the word that it uses is akalika, not sandittika. Yeah? And so again, that reinforcing the point that these two words are actually synonyms. And so again, akalika or sandittika means what can actually be realized and known in this very lifetime. That's really what the meaning of is, in this very life, sandittikam akalikam, in this very life, to be realized in this very life.
Some people take that also to mean that there's no rebirth, right?
Yeah, that's an extension of the understanding of just being timeless in the sense of dependent origination. Yeah, that's used to negate the idea of rebirth, yeah.
Wasn't it particular that some people took that it's to be experienced here and now, like in this lifetime, to mean that it's only this lifetime?
Yeah, something that can't be understood in terms of past and future, yeah. Yeah. So, and then that understanding of it is very much in line with the other aspects of the Dhamma which is mentioned here, ehi pasiko, yeah, inviting inspection, onward leading, opanayiko, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. So they're always talking about the practical aspects of Dhamma, not the theoretical or philosophical aspects, but the practical aspects of Dhamma. So if you want to have a look at these passages on the Buddha Dhamma Sangha in more detail, again, check out the Visuddhimagga. It has a lengthy commentary on all of these words, so each of the words in the chant that we do, it gives like a lot under the contemplation of Buddha Anusati, Dhamma Anusati, Sangha Anusati. It gives a lot of detail about that, so that can help to make that chant more meaningful by giving some more comments and understanding of that.
Could you include a printout of that chant so that we could read it when we're doing it?
Sure. There were some around, yeah. We can see if we can find them. Yeah, we did used to put them out all the time. But I guess we just got complacent, yeah. But no, it should be out because some people don't know it, yeah. Have a look and see if we can find.
Isn't also the Dhamma timeless, the Buddha says that whether there's a target that arises or not, that there's suffering and there's birth, age and death.
Yeah.
Is that another way he uses it?
That's another way that Akalika has been interpreted, yeah. Yeah, the timelessness of the Dhamma. Yeah.
And the timelessness of the realization that it doesn't matter what period of time it is, isn't that another way?
Yeah, that's getting a bit more abstruse, but I couldn't say that I've seen Akalika used in that sense or interpreted in that sense, but it might be, I don't know. But it becomes.
It doesn't expire.
No.
Valid now.
No, that Venerable is referring to a something we discussed earlier in the talking about dependent origination. There's some particular suttas in the Sanyutta Nikaya, if I'm right, this is what you're referring to, where the Buddha talks about a particular development of insight that this Dhamma that I'm seeing now, okay, can be inferred to be the same in the past and the future. Yeah? So it's applied in the context of dependent origination. So just as right now, for example, I can see feeling and it gives rise to craving, then I understand that this is the nature of these things. Yeah? So this is called dhammanvaya, the inference according to Dhamma. So that not only right now can I see craving arising because of feeling, but in the past, whenever craving arose because of feeling, it must have been the same, and in the future it will always be the same. Yeah? This is like understanding the nature of these things. It's called dhammanvaya. Yeah.
Is there anywhere? I for some reason always thought the Akalika meant that it is as applicable now as it was in the Buddha's time.
Mm-hmm.
And is there anywhere that it does say that? Because if a lot of people now are saying, you know, the last 3 years the world's going so quickly that and they sort of like throw out samatha and
yeah.
You know, they add their own, they put their own little thing package together.
Yeah.
Really not. What the Buddha taught. Is there anywhere that he says this is? I thought it was Akalika, that this is time. This is not an expiry date. This is applicable.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the ways that it does get interpreted. I'm not convinced that that's one of the implications of what was actually meant by that phrase in its context. But that idea would be covered by some of the other things, like we mentioned, like the idea of dhammata, that the dhamma, that, like the nature of dhamma, whether tathagatas arise or tathagatas don't arise, then there is this nature of dhamma, yeah, and it remains the same. And so I think there are places where the Buddha says these things, and I think that's clear enough. But I'm again with Akalika, you know, like literally it just means not time-ish, okay? So this is the problem. It says not time-ish. That's literally what Akalika means, okay? So interpret it as you will, you know? It's like, go for it, please. Yeah, and of course this is what people do, and so they find out many, many different ways of interpreting it. But whether that's actually the implication or that was meant by the term, I would have my doubts. Yeah, but, I mean, certainly I agree with the idea, but whether that's what word is actually, that was sort of, was meant by that word, I...
isn't there an interpretation about the Dhamma always has to be experienced in the timeless present moment?
That would be another interpretation, yeah.
But then again, you get all these interpretations, they start to become a bit theological, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. And as I said, like everything in that passage on the Dhamma is very practical, it's very down to earth, you know? So, I mean, again, it's one of those things where I say, yes, of course, you know, the Dhamma actually does have to be experienced in the present moment. And that's, in a sense, that's timeless, yeah? But whether that's actually what was meant by the word, yeah.
It's a bit like how many angels can dance on the head of an eagle.
Pin, yeah, which is actually discussed in the Suttimagga, I think. Or in the Atthasalani or something, yeah.
It appears in the Suttimagga.
Yeah.
So basically it means to be experiencing this lifetime.
I reckon. This is the official, this has the Sujato stamp of approval as the interpretation. Now, just backing up a little bit, check in with the Chinese versions of the sutta. When the Pali discourse starts with the Buddha addressing the monks on his own, the three Chinese versions report that the arrival of a Brahmin was the occasion for the Buddha to deliver the present discourse. The same Brahmin, Sundarika Bharadwaja, occurs again at the end of all versions, including the Pali version, posing the Buddha a question about ritual bathing in holy rivers. And this same, the Bharadwaja clan appear quite commonly in the suttas. And the Sundarika Bharadwaja occurs quite a few times also. Regarding this Brahman, the Ekotra Agama version provides additional and quite interesting details. According to its reports, this Brahman felt quite confident of his own spiritual purity compared with the Buddha, as he only took simple food, while the Buddha sometimes took succulent and rich food. This thought of the Brahman of which the Buddha had become aware was what, according to the Ekotra Agama version, led to the present discourse. So we'll see a little bit later on how that maybe has some relevance or interest in the sutta. The sequence of these things is a little bit different in the Chinese versions. All of the Chinese versions, the Buddha doesn't give the simile of the cloth first. He gives the list of defilements first and then gives the simile of the cloth afterwards. The list of defilements as such, being similar in all of the versions, although, as usual, having a few minor points of difference. Okay. Just to mention that there's something a little bit unusual in the presentation, these few verses. So someone who's known that all of these things are imperfections abandons them and then effectively attains stream entry as a result of that. Now, that's a little bit strange because things like, for example, ill will, anger, and so on are usually felt to be defilements which are abandoned by the non-returner and not by the stream enterer. Conceit being a defilement which even the non-returner still has and only abandoned by the arahant and so on. So these certainly not a list of defilements which is closely connected with stream entry as normally understood, and one might wonder exactly what is meant by this. Now, again, according to I'll just continue with the Pali version, again being slightly different in the Chinese versions here. So when he's given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished the imperfections of the mind in part, according to the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation here, I'll come back to that in a minute, he considers thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Buddha, he gains inspiration in the meaning, he gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he's glad, rapture is born in him. In one who's rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. In one whose body is tranquil, feels pleasure. In one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. He considers thus, I'm possessed of perfect confidence in the Dhamma. I'm possessed of perfect confidence in the Sangha. And similarly, his mind becomes concentrated. So, now, I'll just read on. Okay, I'll come back to that note about expelling them in part. Now, Bhikkhu Bodhi has some notes here about this. Comes back to that question I mentioned about what's the nature of these defilements. Is how are these defilements abandoned? What does it actually mean, this, when it's talking about this in this particular context? And Bhikkhu Bodhi's note here says, the abandoning, according to the commentary, the abandoning spoken of here should be understood as abandonment by eradication, that is, complete uprooting by the supramundane path. So it's not simply the suppression of them, but the complete abandoning of these defilements. So this, again, refers to the commentarial analysis of defilements, which lists three levels of abandoning of defilement. I think I mentioned this a week or two ago, but three levels. One is just the simple non-occurrence of defilements. So maybe, you know, just the you know, you might not be feeling angry, and then the defilement of anger doesn't occur to you. Then the second level being the abandonment, suppression through samadhi. So you get into a state of samadhi and the defilements are cleaned out of the mind, but the underlying tendency is still there. And then the third level is the complete eradication. So according to the commentary, this is talking about the complete eradication of these things, and thus is referring to the path of not the, according to the commentary, 16 defilements are abandoned by the noble paths in the following order. The path of stream entry abandons contempt, a domineering attitude, envy, avarice, deceit, and fraud. The path of non-returning abandons ill will, anger, revenge, and negligence. The path of arahantship abandons covetousness and unrighteous greed, obstinacy, presumption, conceit, arrogance, and vanity. So, again, this the accuracy of this list is certainly questionable. For example, covetousness and unrighteous greed, one would normally think that these things would be abandoned by a non-returner as abandoned sensual desire. The deceit, maya, is not so... it's not really a technical term so much, but again, it would seem to me that that's associated with ignorance and perhaps is only abandoned by the arahant. In any case, the commentary maintains by reference to an ancient exegetical source that in this passage the path of the non-returner is being described. So the ancient exegetical source, of course, being one of the old Sinhalese commentaries, which Buddhaghosa was using in compiling his commentary. Therefore, we must understand that those defilements to be fully abandoned by the path of arahantship have at this point only been abandoned in part by way of their coarser manifestations. So, interesting to note Bhikkhu Bodhi's language here. The commentary says something, therefore we must understand. Interesting way of putting it, therefore... One might have phrased it, the commentary says blah blah blah. If the commentary is correct, this would apply that. This would imply that X, Y, Z. There's a number of other possible interpretations here. One is that it's not talking about the full abandoning, but perhaps the suppression of these defilements to a certain degree. Or perhaps that there is some editorial glitches in the sutta. So when we talk about the Chinese version in a minute, we'll come back to that.
I think that in part maybe it means stream entry, because there it says considers thus and the sense of unwavering confidence in the Buddha, which is something a stream entry.
Exactly, absolutely.
So yeah. I think that this. I also think that the recollection of Buddha Dhamma Sangha is probably maybe even a practice for a stream entry, because they have that quality already.
Mm-hmm.
That they have no doubt in that, and recollecting that, thus like it says here. That gains gladness, connected with the Dhamma, and so on and so forth, and becomes concentrated.
For sure, yeah.
So, obviously, you don't have unwavering faith and confidence in the Buddha if you're not a stream entry, So, I think perhaps it could mean stream entry.
I think most likely you're right, yeah. That's certainly the most straightforward interpretation. So regarding the phrase here, yatodhi, is in part, so we're back up to section 8 now, when he's given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished the imperfections of the mind in part. Right? Now, Bhikkhu Bodhi's note on this translation follows the reading yatodhi. He doesn't give what the other alternative readings are. And the commentary's explanation of this as the partial abandoning of defilements by the first three parts, contrasted with the total anodhi abandoning of defilements by the fourth and final path. Okay, so this being the interpretation of the commentary interpreting it that when it says in part there, it means that you've given up all of those defilements associated with the first three paths and not with the arahantship. Nyanamoli, following the reading Yatodhi, does anyone, seems a bit strange, does anyone have a, he's given two interpretations based on two readings here, but the two readings in my edition are the same. Maybe the updated version, maybe there might be a, I wonder if that's a, Nyanamoli, anyway, I'll just read the passage. Note 90.
It's the same note.
This translation follows the reading Yatodi and the NA's explanation.
Can I just have to finish that? Ah, Yatodi. Oh no, sorry, yeah, he's right. I missed the spelling mistake. Yatodi, okay. Not Yatodi, I was looking for the wrong spelling mistake. Okay. Okay, so two different readings. Yatodi and Yatodi. Okay. Yanamoli, following the reading, Yatodi translates, and whatever from among these imperfections has according to the limitation. So this is the reading Yatodi, is according to the limitation set by whichever of the first three paths he has attained, been given up, has been forever dropped, let go, abandoned, relinquished. So the implications of Nyanamoli's reading was that it could have been someone on any of the three early paths, Supreme Mentor, Master Returner, or Non-Returner, whereas according to the commentary, it has to be the Non-Returner only. Again, a slightly uncertain point there. So I'll just continue on a little bit more, because the resolution of some of these issues may be found from the comparing with the Chinese, but we have to have a look at the structure of it to sort of see or understand the difference here. So now, up to somebody who's abandoned some of those defilements, used their perfect confidence as a basis for recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, to gain samadhi, and then the sutta goes on. Because if a bhikkhu of such a virtue, such a dhamma, and such wisdom, again another slightly uncertain phrase here. It's obviously sila, dhamma, and panya being a slightly unusual thing. Now, of course, we normally expect sila, samadhi, panya, and the commentary interprets dhamma here as meaning samadhi, but why the text doesn't use samadhi is not clear. Such a virtue, such a dhamma, and such wisdom eats alms food consisting of choice hill rice along with various sauces, curries, and even if they were to have pizza with ice cream following, then that would be no obstacle for him. Just as a cloth that is defiled and stained becomes pure and bright with the help of clear water, or just as gold becomes pure and bright with the help of a furnace, so too if a bhikkhu of such a virtue eats alms food, that will be no obstacle for him. He abides pervading one quarter, one direction, with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, the third, the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with appreciative joy, and with equanimity. Likewise, the second, the third, the fourth, above, below, around, everywhere, and to all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So we've gone from the Buddha Anusati to the idea that you haven't got any food is not an obstacle, to now doing the four Brahma Viharas. And of course, this being the very beautiful standard passage on the Brahma Viharas found countless times throughout the suttas. Now, an interesting difference here. All versions next speak of becoming aware of these mental defilements and abandoning them. The Chinese versions follow such removal with the development of the four Brahma Viharas in the form of a boundless radiation. Okay, so in the Chinese versions, all of them, after the abandoning of the upakilesas, then comes the development of the four Brahma Viharas. The Pali discourse, however, speaks at this point first of perfect confidence in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, an implicit reference to stream entry, and only turns to the four Brahma Viharas later on. The Madhyama Agama version and the individual translation conclude their description of the four Brahma Viharas with the Buddha pointing out that in this way, an internal bathing, an inner bathing of the mind can be undertaken different from an outer bathing of the body. And these two versions continue by reporting that a Brahmin intervened at this point and asked the Buddha about purification by bathing in sacred rivers. So the two Chinese versions don't seem to mention at least not at this point, the idea of perfect confidence in the Triple Gem. They just go straight from abandoning the Upakilesas to the four Brahma Viharas, and then the Brahma, and then saying this is the inner bathing, at which time the Brahman asked him the question about inner bathing. So a shorter exposition there. And one which has a certain degree of plausibility. We've seen that there are these interpretive difficulties with the Pali version, actually sort of trying to reconcile the descriptions with the standard understanding of these things. It being a very natural thing, if the Buddha was in fact speaking with the intent to convert a Brahmin, that he should have used the discourse on the Brahma Viharas as a way of converting him. The Buddha did this on a number of occasions, and that was quite characteristic of his style, that he would use the Brahma Viharas or certain other teachings that were relevant or accessible to the Brahmins when trying to convert them. So the Pali, the only version which does mention the confidence in the Triple Gem is the Ekotra Agama version. And the Ekotra Agama version puts this after the description of the Brahma Viharas, not before it as in the Pali. And not only is there that difference, but another difference is that the way that this phrase is given is somewhat different. So this is slightly unusual, because normally what you find in the suttas, the different versions in Chinese or whatever, that it's quite common that the structures, the organization of the sutta will be different. That's quite common, quite expected, quite normal. But it's unusual to find that there's major differences in the actual, the what they call the pericopes, the basic textual units, such as the recollection of the Triple Gem. However, in this respect, the Ekotra Agama is delightfully eccentric and gives us many, many different and highly unusual presentations of different kinds of dhammas. There's maybe four or five different presentations of the Eightfold Path within the Ekotra Agama, something which is completely consistent throughout every other known text and collection and period of Buddhism everywhere. The Eightfold Path is always the same, and the Ekotra quite gleefully goes along and gives us all these different versions which are completely internally inconsistent. I think they were... I don't know about these guys who put together the Ekotra Agama. I don't know quite what they were on, but maybe they're up in the Himalayas and hanging out with the sadhus or something like that. But it's quite a trippy kind of collection. Anyway, in the description of the Dhammanusati, we've already seen what the Pali has for Dhammanusati, but the Chinese, the Ekotra Agama version, speaks of it, the Dhamma, as being very pure, something that cannot be shaken, being respected and loved by the people, and causing joy when inspected by the wise. Okay? So that's quite different than the Pali version. Yeah? Something that cannot be shaken, respected and loved by the people, and causing joy when inspected by the wise. Yeah. And in Sanghanusati, as well as the Ekotra Agama version, refers to the Sangha as the four pairs and eight persons. The four pairs, of course, stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and arahant, and the eight persons being each of those four divided according to the path and fruit. So one on the path to stream entry and stream enterer, the one on the path to once returner and once returner, and so on, making four pairs or eight persons. To this, the Ekotra Agama version adds, among others, that its members are accomplished in moral conduct, concentration, wisdom, liberation, and knowledge and vision of liberation. So again, this being a different description than the Pali, not of course inconsistent in any way, but certainly different in terms of the letter. The Ekotra Agama then continues its account with the gain of the three higher knowledges, so the three vidya, not mentioned in the Pali discourse at all. For one accomplished in this way, this discourse indicates even taking delicious food will not constitute an obstacle, since all desires have been eradicated in him. So preceding the radiation of the Brahma Viharas, the Pali discourse also had a similar reference to taking delicious food. In the Pali account, this passage appears a little surprising. In between the gain of perfect confidence and the development of the Brahma Viharas, and its implications remain somewhat obscure in the discourse. The Pali commentary explains this statement to represent the gain of non-returning, since taking delicious food will not obstruct a non-returner from progress to full awakening. Of course, the non-returner having overcome sensual desire and not being attached to food. According to Analio, this explanation appears a bit contrived, since though delicious food will indeed not affect a non-returner or an arahant, it does not follow from this that to be beyond the attraction of delicious food would necessarily imply that one is at least a non-returner, since it should be possible to remain unaffected by delicious food even if one has not yet gained such a lofty level of realization. So that being a not particularly clear at that point, but anyway, I'll just go on. The Vatupamaputra Sutta, the Pali version at this point, speaks of aloofness from the attraction of food for one who is of such virtue, such nature, and such wisdom. Since the preceding passage spoke about perfect confidence in the three gems representative of stream entry, the introductory reference to such virtue should refer to the same level of awakening. Okay, so the point is that this phrase, which we've got on paragraph 12 of our sutta, I mentioned before, such sila, such dhamma, and such wisdom, obviously referring to what's happened previously in the sutta. And what's happened previously is someone has perfect confidence, which refers to a stream enterer. Hence, the material provided by the Vatupama Sutta does not support identifying this passage as representative of gaining non-returner. It may rather seem that the puzzling placement of the reference to taking delicious food at a point between an earlier reference to stream entry and a later description of insight leading to full awakening has led the commentary to give its explanation, attempting to make sense out of this placement. In other words, there's a textual confusion or problem in the text, and that the commentary has sort of attempted to make sense out of this. Here, the Akotra Agama offers a more convincing explanation for this passage, since by placing the topic of aloofness from delicious food after full awakening, it establishes a clear relation between the two, indicating that such aloofness is one of the qualities resulting from having eradicated all defilements. The Akotra Agama account also clarifies the relation of this passage to the Vatupama Sutta as a whole, since it was just such taking of delicious food by the Buddha which had caused the Brahman Sundarika Bharadwaja to underestimate the degree of purification the Buddha had reached. Thus, in its account, the present passage forms a direct reply to this misconception of the Brahman which had motivated the Buddha to deliver this discourse. So that's quite a nice little point there from the Chinese. So the point being here in this particular Chinese version, the Akotra Agama, right at the beginning, the Brahman comes along and says, I'm more pure than him because he eats all this delicious food and then I do all these fasts and things like that. So the Buddha gives up the whole discourse leading to arahantship and says, for one of such a nature, even if they eat delicious food, it's not a problem for them. And so it's quite directly answering the situation. So it seems that in this case, the Pali version has kind of lost the context, kind of a bit confused about the context, lost maybe the setting. And I've mentioned before that often the setting is one of the looser parts of a sutta, and so when the setting gets lost, then sometimes, often it might not matter. You know, if you say it's set in Savatthi or set in Rajagaha, then who cares? But sometimes the setting's giving us some narrative context which is actually helping us to make sense of the sutta as a whole. And so in this case, maybe the setting was lost or confused, and then as a result, the sutta itself became a bit confused, and then the commentary, of course, trying to make sense out of the confusion and developing a sort of contrived explanation for that.
Isn't it in there that the Pali doesn't have the three higher knowledges? I think it does here, number 18.
Just the liberation from defilements, yeah? Doesn't have the three knowledges, the Tevija, just has arahantship. Three knowledges, is that correct? Collection of past lives? Yeah, and the divine eye, so that kind of standard passage we chanted from the last week. It doesn't have that. Yeah, that's the third one, so it doesn't have that. So now then the Pali event version then goes on to say, after the Brahma Viharas, he says, he understands thus, there is this, there is the inferior, there is the superior, and beyond there is an escape from this whole field of perception. Of course, this being a passage which is completely transparent and obvious and needs no comment, so. Now that particular passage, also not found in the Chinese version, in the Akotra Agama version, interestingly enough, it does occur elsewhere in the Majjhima Agama, but not in this particular context. So, What does that mean? Anyone have any suggestions? There is this, there is the inferior, there is the superior, and beyond there is an escape from this whole field of perception.
The cessation of perception of feeling is only available to non-Buddhas and Arahants.
Is what?
The Nirodha Samsara.
Mm-hmm. But what is that? How does that relate to that passage?
Because it goes from loving kindness to equanimity to that. Is that what you mean?
I mean, what does it say when it says there is this? What's this? There is the inferior, there's the inferior, there's the superior. What's the superior? Ah, boring. I don't want anyone just starting to regurgitating Bhikkhu Bodhi's cheat notes like I do. You don't want to spoil it for everybody else. Okay, the present section shows according to the commentary, the present section shows the non-returner's practice of insight meditation aimed at arahantship, and the following section his attainment of arahantship. The phrase, there is this, signifies the truth of suffering. There is the inferior, is the origin of suffering. There is the superior, the truth of the path. And the escape from this whole field of perception is nibbana, the cessation of suffering. So it correlates those things with the Four Noble Truths, which is quite nice. Is there any other possible way of understanding it?
Yes, but I've forgotten.
Ah, either.
Someone was on that Saturday.
Yeah, I gave another one on the Outlaws.
Yeah, it fitted as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is this world, and then there's the inferior world, the superior world.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond is the escape, beyond this world, you could say, is escape from the whole world of perception.
Yeah, that's another way of doing it. For me, the most natural way to understand it is in terms of just the context where it's coming out of the Brahma Viharas, and then there is this, would surely refer to the Brahma Viharas, yeah? There is the inferior, referring to sense sphere existence, yeah? So, you know, this is the pleasures and pains of the sensual realm. Superior, formless attainments, yeah? And then there's the escape from all of this whole field of perception. Yeah. So it seems to me that's anyway, I don't know, it's my interpretation, and surprisingly enough, it seems to me better than the one found in the commentary. But, I mean, it seems to me, because it's coming directly out of the thing on the Brahma Viharas, and also because this idea of the field of perception is used in this context in a way talking about, like, particular ways of seeing in meditation, yeah? And so it would seem to me it's quite natural to talk about that as being like comparing the different kinds of meditation, the perception you have when you're in the Brahma Viharas, the perception you have in the formless attainments, these are different kinds of sanya or perception. And so it seems to me that's quite a natural reading.
Prante, what about, you could say, there is this, which is what is here now, and the body and so on, and there is the inferior, which is not saying the present. And then there is a superior, which is understanding it, and then there's the escape, which is nirvana.
Yeah, you could have said that. Yeah.
It's another one of those
could
very...
Could you say death for escape?
Well, there's many different ways you can interpret it.
Eva thinks death is escape. So... But I mean, what's actually interesting, I think, about this is that there is this cryptic kind of phrase. It's obviously meant as an extremely advanced kind of thing in insight meditation. Perhaps we're not really going to understand it until we're kind of there and we've gone through all of these things and we're there and the kind of mind comes out of this kind of thing. There is this, you know, there's the inferior, there's the superior. That's it, and then you agree on it. Because, you know, when the Buddha expressed these very deep kinds of insights, you know, he often did it using this very, very kind of cryptic language, yeah? Which is very, very beautiful, you know, like in the Bahya Sutta, you know, there's neither here nor between, neither here nor there, nor in between the two, that just this is the ending of suffering. You know, there is no herein. For him, there is no herein, there is no therein. When there's no therein, there's no thereby. And when there's no thereby, there's neither here nor there or beyond the two. Just this is the ending of suffering. So this is a very very kind of beautiful but very enigmatic way that these very deep insights are sometimes expressed. Okay, so when he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. So, of course, the three asavas. When it's liberated, there comes the knowledge, it is liberated. He understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what has had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. Because this bhikkhu is one called bathed in with the inner bathing. Now, of course, in the Chinese version, sorry, in the Pali version we've just been reading, then that statement about being bathed with the inner bathing just comes right at the end without any preparation, you know, and it's like, oh, well, obviously there's a context for it, you know. And the context given in Sutta, there's obviously a Brahmin, Sundarika, is hanging around, and the Buddha gives that for his benefit.
It doesn't make sense, really, because it would only make sense if Sundarika came first, and then he said,
right. Yeah, certainly it's quite abrupt. But, you know, we can understand these kinds of things in terms of the oral tradition, that you know, what this is doing, what the sutta itself is doing is like, it was actually, it's just capturing or remarking on that kind of thing, which would have been then expanded by the teacher in the oral tradition, so that the teacher in classic Indian style would have probably told you all about the Sundarika Bharadwaja and what he'd done in his past lives and, you know, who his family was and blah, 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 and gone on this whole kind of thing about that, and then come around and then say, oh, there, here he was sitting there. So this is often, it's just used as like a touchstone to sort of, give the context. So it's quite characteristic of the sutta idiom that it just gives you that hint as to what the context was. Now, on that occasion, the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadwaja was sitting not far from the Blessed One. And then he said to the Blessed One, just as another interesting textual point, of course, the whole sutra is just throughout just referring to bhikkhus, and this is the conventional mode of address, but obviously here we have a Brahmin layperson sitting around there. So when it says the sutra's addressed to the bhikkhus, it certainly doesn't exclude the possibility of bhikkhunis or lay people and so on being present at the discourses. Most of the time they probably were. Then he said to the Blessed One, but does Master Gotama go to the Bahuka River to bathe? Buddha says, why, Brahman, go to the Bahuka River? What can the Bahuka River do? Master Gotama, the Bahuka River is said by many to give liberation, is held by many to give merit, and many wash away their evil actions in the Bahuka River. So this, of course, being a very ancient and universal religious practice of baptism, washing away one's sins in the water and all of these kinds of things, being found across many different religious traditions, of course, from the Judeo-Christian tradition, baptism is still one of the rituals that's done, and they still believe in the efficacy of it. So you have a baptism as a child, and if you don't have your baptism, then you're going to go to hell, you know, so they still basically believe that. I don't know if anyone believes it, but anyway, they're supposed to believe it. It's a party line. I don't know whether anyone actually believes it. That sort of a very sedate thing, which is sort of stemmed from the much more kind of radical idea. You know, you can think of John the Baptist as kind of getting Jesus and plunging him into the river and so on. And there was kind of, you used to kind of really sort of wash yourself away in the river. And this coming from idea that I talked about in some of the earlier sutta classes of this evolution of the idea of religious purity evolving from a much more materialistic idea towards a more spiritual idea. So we talked about this in the context of the asavas as being like in Buddhism being a mental or psychological quality of the mind which you have to purify, which is what's being presented here, as in contrast with an actual almost physical thing, and this being like one of the progressions in the development or the evolution of religions, that earlier kind of religions, more primitive, tended to see sin as like a physical thing, which could be washed away by this kind of physical washing. And so the Buddha reforming it, as, you know, was reformed within the Brahmanical religion, was also reformed. You had this kind of idea was taught the period before the Buddha in the Brahmanas. And you have these, you have just a few, kind of poking its head up in a few little places. And in one very interesting little place where it's talking about the performance of some kind of ritual. And of course, these rituals, they take them very, very seriously. Like the Brahmin has to get up in the morning before the dawn and do some kind of ritual to worship the sun. Otherwise, the sun's not going to come up, right? Okay, and if the Brahmins didn't worship the sun in the right way, then the sun wouldn't rise. So this is why it's very, very important that they keep doing the rituals. Now, a number of interesting issues here. Well, what if they don't do it? Well, of course, there's a Brahmin somewhere else who's doing it, right? So they get enough of them doing it and somebody's going to get up in time, right? Well, that's good. Another interesting issue, and this is a question that was raised by the anthropologist Levi Strauss, and he said, but why don't the Brahmins get up in the middle of the night and do the ritual to make the sun come up when they need some light in the middle of the night? Why do they light a lamp like everybody else does when they, in the middle of the night when they need some light and they don't do the ritual? Yeah? It's quite an interesting little point there, but don't want to go into that now. But then the other thing is in this passage in the Brahmanas, it then says that, oh, if you can't do it because of any of these ways, any of these reasons, you can't do it. If you can't do it in this way, then you should do it in that way. If you can't get, say, some of the ingredients you need, you know, or if you can't do it for the blah, blah, blah. And then if you can't do it in any of those ways, then you can do it by faith. Yeah? So this is the last option, that you can do it by faith. It means you don't actually have to do it, but it seems to me like a mental thing. You actually just go through it. That's good enough.
Digression.
Darryl, yeah.
Brahmins.
Mm.
I think of Brahmins, I think of one of the castes in the Hindu.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So the Brahmin.
There existed a Brahmin religion, is it?
Yeah, the Brahmin caste were the custodians and teachers of the Brahmanical religion. Okay? So the ancestral duty of that caste was to memorize the ancient scriptures, which were the Vedas, to pass them down through the culture, and to perform the rituals and so on which were prescribed in the Vedas. That's like the classical idea of the Brahmin. It's not clear to what extent that was, to what extent that might have been or might not have been a racial difference. Okay, so there was actually like, you know, different races of people moved into India at different times, and that was a kind of a remnant of that. That's kind of not particularly clear. Of course, the Brahmins themselves are very much insistent on the idea of purity by birth. Okay, so, you know, and this is a theme we find again and again mentioned in the sutta, that they mention that, you know, you have to, both your parents have to be Brahmins and all of these kinds of things. So there's purity of birth. So they're like maintaining the pure blood of the Brahmins. But again, this is very interesting to look at how that's handled practically in the Upanishads. There's this very wonderful story of a fellow called Satyakama. And he says to his mother, Mother, I want to go forth. I want to find Brahman. And the mother says, okay, son, if you want to go forth and find Brahman, then that's what you should do. And Satyakama says, Mum, just by the way, you've kind of brought me up and all of this kind of thing, and I've never known my father. Do you reckon you could just, what was my father's name? Because when I go to find a teacher, they'll ask me my father's name, so I don't know what my family name is. And the mother says, oh, well, son, you know how things are. And when I was a young woman, I sort of got around a little bit here and there. And I can't say I exactly know who your father's name was. Yeah. And so he says, oh, all right. So he goes off to find this Brahmin teacher. And the Brahmin teacher says, okay, what's your family name? And he says, oh, well, actually, you know, my mother sort of got around a bit when she was young. And I don't really know who my father is. And the teacher says, ah, sadhu, 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 only a true Brahmin could have had that level of truth and honesty. Yeah? Yeah? So this was the true Brahmin. Yeah? So very interesting, it has kind of all these notions of purity. But that's in the Brahmanical text itself. Yeah?
Ante, I was reading a talk by one of the Shankaracharyas
mm-hmm.
recently.
Mm.
I think one from the south. And he was saying that because a traditional Vedic education is almost dying out in India, Brahmins aren't fulfilling their proper role of doing the mantras and all the sacrifices. But this is a reason there is chaos in the world.
Right.
And if the Brahmins stop doing the mantras, it's going to cause a great catastrophe.
Yeah.
So he still got that. He was really harping on about how they have to live the simple life and do the rituals and do the mantras. And
Yeah.
So it's still there.
Maybe they should just develop like a computer program to do it instead. Then you wouldn't have to worry about it.
And also, Bhante, you were saying with the water, the purification, so is this where the origin of the term stream mantra comes from?
Ah, that's another controversial issue, believe it or not. Sotapanna, does it mean one who's, literally it seems to mean one who's attained the stream. So whether that's the image that somebody had, to me the most obvious image is it's like somebody who's dived into the Ganges River and they're going to be washed all the way down the Ganges to the great ocean of Nibbana. It seems to me the most obvious metaphorical application of that. Whether it means you've washed yourself in the river, it's another possibility. Another thing is that sota also means ear. And the disciples of the Buddha who are on the path are regarded as shravakas, which means listeners or hearers. So one interpretation, this was advanced quite forcefully by Peter Masefield, who's a Buddhist professor, used to be in Sydney, is now in Bangkok. And he argued that sotapanna means one who has opened his ears. I'm not convinced by his arguments there. To me, the natural interpretation seems to me one who's plunged into the river.
Also, the Buddha asked Sariputta some questions, and then I forgot the first part of it. Then he says, "What is the stream?"
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "The stream is just
is the path." Exactly, yeah.
So he enters that.
So it's obviously a stream being similar to a path, yeah?
So entering into the stream is entering into the Noble Eightfold Path.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But this is, you could also say it's like the Buddha would reinterpret Brahman concepts.
Mm-hmm. For sure, which is what he's doing, obviously, when he says bathe with the inner bathing, that's obviously quite explicit. Yeah, look, it could be. It could be. Yeah. Not at all impossible. Okay, so then comes to the verses. Bahuka and Adhikaka, Gaya and Sundarika too, Payaga and Sarasati, and the river Bahumati. A fool may there forever bathe, yet will not purify dark deeds. So these are obviously names of rivers, apart from Gaya. They're not particularly well-known ones. Sarasvati, maybe the Sarasvati River, which was like the central river in the Vedic period, and Sarasvati River was in the northwest of India and has dried up. Was in the second millennium, dried up due to geological changes, and in the Indus Valley civilization, you find one of the Indus Valley has these curious cities which are found over a huge area. It was a massive civilization, and these cities constructed according to this very organized sort of town planning, which was like the same in every city across like thousands of kilometers of northern India, from Pakistan nearly as far as the Ganges Valley. They had cities all over this place with the same kind of planning, with like regular organized streets and sewers and drainage and all of these kinds of things. It's like, you know, they could do it 5,000 years ago, but they can't do it today. I don't know what's happened in the meantime. But one of the unusual things about the Indus Valley civilizations is that they have relatively little monumental architecture. They don't have the big pyramids and things like that, which you expect. And It's almost like what seems from its remnants seems quite a prosaic culture. Like it's just kind of regular streets with you know, comfortable but fairly undecorated houses and not much artwork, only these small seals which we have, no large scale artwork or anything like that, and no large scale monumental architecture. But the only thing which you do have is quite large, what looks like bathing pools, yeah, and which were probably used for various purposes, but which may well have been used for ritual bathing in those times. And some of the seals, one of the seals in particular, has a picture of what's been interpreted as a goddess standing within the Bodhi tree. So it has the Bodhi tree, and then a goddess standing within that, and then seven other goddesses standing next to it, which has been interpreted as the seven rivers. So in the Vedas it has the seven rivers, the Sapta Nadi, I can't remember the exact phrase that they use. These days they call it the Punjab, of course. Pancha Arpa, the five waters, is the Punjab. Yeah? In those days it was the seven rivers. And the queen of all those seven rivers was Sarasvati. Yeah? It was the river which came down from the Himalaya.
When you talk, you have talked about this before, but interesting, it just popped in my mind that the image of the goddess in the Bodhi tree, according to the commentary of thing, when the Buddha touched the earth as his witness, and
right.
The goddess there.
Yes, right.
Associated with the Bodhi tree long time beforehand.
Yeah, yeah.
And then drawn out again in the commentary.
Interesting.
She's wringing out her hair.
Yeah, like water, a stream, yeah, with water, yeah.
So that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Also, you have the image of Shiva with the Ganges flowing in through his matted locks.
Yeah, yeah, that's a classic.
They had a TV show about those cities recently on SBS. And they couldn't work out why they're in the middle of the desert. But then they've discovered that there'd been an earthquake.
Right.
And the river had shifted its course.
Right. Did it give a date for the earthquake?
Oh.
I've heard a date, I think the last date I heard was about 1600 BC.
I can't figure it out.
Yeah.
It's quite a long time ago, but they had this whole elaborate system of irrigation.
Yeah, yeah.
And these tanks that would fill up. But then they found that underground there's a river flowing underground.
Oh, really?
Been drilling into it for irrigation.
Oh, really?
So it's quite fascinating.
Yeah.
They said they had like public toilets and drainage and
amazing, yeah, truly amazing. And the whole Indus Valley thing is very, very controversial. And one question being, is it an indigenous Indian civilization, or was it seeded from Mesopotamia? There are some evidences of trade between Indus Valley and Mesopotamian and Babylonian civilizations. But the last thing I heard was that there was actually newly discovered sites where there was like a series of towns and villages, like developing into towns and then towns developing into cities on one site, which seemed to show that it was like a local kind of evolution sort of in within India, and that the oldest strata of that was about 7000 BC and then sort of gradually building up, and then it's sort of the height of the civilization about 2000 BC or 2500 BC, something like that. Yeah, and then collapsed according to reasons unknown, not being sure. The traditional explanation was that the Aryans, when they came in, destroyed it, invaded and destroyed the civilization, but that being extremely controversial, there's not much evidence for a violent end to the Indus Valley civilization at all.
I think I remember then that this is another theory, that there was an earthquake, geological evidence or something, and then the river either dried up or...
Yeah.
And then maybe that was just became unviable, and then they just
dispersed, and broke up. Well, that was one of the characteristics, is that there's a great book called The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And one of the things he talks about there is that civilizations of that era were extremely fragile, depending on those kinds of shifts in climate and things like that. They weren't flexible. They had their systems which were set up, and when things were very stable, they were very, very strong, but they didn't have the adaptability to be able to change. So when they had that kind of thing happen, they weren't able to cope with it, and then it would just all fall apart and then sort of slowly and painfully be rebuilt again.
They had the same thing happen in South America.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
In the desert.
And then
they finally worked out that all these abandoned cities, like big, huge earthen mounds, which were pyramids that dissolved. They found that the evidence was that there'd been a shift in the weather pattern of the El Nino to the El Nina, La Nina or something, and then that had incredible rain, and they'd just gotten washed out.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, there was I think it was extended drought or something.
Okay, so the verses go on. What can the Sundarika bring to pass? What the Payaga? What the Bahuka? They cannot purify an evildoer, a man who has done cruel and brutal deeds. One pure in heart has evermore the feast of spring, the holy day. So, of course, these being again reference to the auspicious days of the Brahmins. The Pali has Pagu, a day of Brahmanical purification in the month of Paguna, February and March, and Uposatha, the religious observance days regulated by the lunar calendar. One fair in act, one pure in heart, brings his virtue to perfection. It is here, Brahman, that you should bathe, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is not offered, with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to go to Gaya? For any well will be your Gaya. When this was said, the Brahman Sundarika Bharadvaja said, magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, or as Venerable Tanisaro translates it, awesome. Awesome, man. Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what had been hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama, I would receive the full admission. And the Brahman Sundarika Bharadvaja received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission. And soon, not long after his full admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Bharadvaja, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. So this being a kind of inspiring and phrase which is found at the end of many suttas, and a very long, complicated sentence, and in Pali the syntax is even more complex and difficult to unravel. He directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being, and the Venerable Bharadvaja became one of the Arahants. So, just before we finish, just a couple more interesting points from the comparing with the Chinese versions. Now, here in this one, of course, Sundarika Bharadvaja asking for the going forth and then becoming an Arahant. Now, the two Samyukta Agama versions conclude by simply reporting that the Brahman was convinced by the Buddha's explanation. Okay, so that's all. He just said, okay, I accept your explanation. That's all. Whereas according to the Madhyama Agama version and the individual translation, he took refuge as a lay follower. Okay, so this is another stage. One is he just, oh yes, okay, well that sounds reasonable. Another one is, okay, I want to take refuge. According to the Pali and the Ekotara Agama account, he went forth and became an Arahant. Okay, so a different account. So this is another point which, you know, I've made before, but it's very important to bear in mind. These endings that are put on the end of the suttas, not necessarily very reliable at all in terms of what's actually happening. Well, we don't really know. Of course, they're not at all incompatible. It's quite possible, you know, it's quite possible the Pali is simply giving a more full account and the other ones are also quite true. There's no contradiction there. But we're left sort of wondering exactly what did happen and whether he did actually go forth or what's the case. Looking back on the six versions of this meeting between the Buddha and the Brahman Sundarika Bharadvaja, the different versions can be grouped into three groups of two, each group giving a somewhat different presentation of the Buddha's exposition and of its effect on the Brahman. Okay, so here, Analeo is attempting a little bit of cladistic analysis, so he's trying to sort them out, and so to not just say, well, we have these six different versions and we can't really say too much about them, but we can actually say in this case that we can sort them out into different groups, which makes sense. This is something which is very similar to what you do, for example, if you're doing biology and you have to sort of sort out, you know, 10 million species of frogs and what is the relationship between them, and you know, and you've got to look at the color of them and the size and the shape and blah 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 and the lifestyle and behavior, and you've got to sort out which ones, how do you, and of course, a very complex matter. Very little work has been done in this field in the suttas. Analeo doesn't attempt, usually in his essays, to to draw this kind of map of the territory. The reason being, of course, that it's so difficult to do that. One sutta may have something in common with the other one, but then something different. And then this one might have something in common in that one, but then something different as well. So it's, the interrelationship between them is not at all obvious. However, in this particular case, we are able to make some generalizations about their relationship. The two Samyutta Agama versions offer the shortest and most simple account. Here we find the Buddha meeting a Brahmin on the bank of a river, and the latter, apparently thinking that the Buddha had come to take a ritual bath, brought up the subject of water purification. In reply, the Buddha pointed out that the real purification needs to be undertaken in the realm of moral conduct, a reply which satisfied the Brahmin. Okay? So that's a fairly straightforward narrative, nothing particularly profound about it, but giving a pretty straightforward, pretty sensible interpretation. Oh, I seem to be missing one page here. Is that right? 17, 19. I think there's one more page on the.
Dante, you know that controversy about the heart and mind, the Hidaya?
That's okay.
They had it on the TV the other night. They found there's people that are having heart transplants.
Mm.
And they're having total personality changes.
Yeah, they're talking about that. Kim was talking about that at the talk on Friday night. Yeah, they said talking about
that. Yeah, now you can get some memories.
Mm.
Yeah.
It was a movie, wasn't it?
And they found electrical impulses on the heart correlate to like mental impulses.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
It's people having total personality changes and memories of the person.
Yeah.
And karma changes then.
Well, this is raises these very interesting issues about identity and so on.
Yeah.
We had a book about that in Perth. When I was there about 10 years ago, there was a book published about it called, do you remember what it was called? It was quite a sensation among the monks at the time. We all kind of read it, but it was about probably before you arrived there. It was called, I can't remember what it's called now, but it had quite a variety of these kinds of cases. But it seems like now it's maybe becoming more better established. Some of the cases were quite funny, like the case of the guy who's like a 50-year-old lover of classical music. And then he sort of dies and then has a heart attack and then has his heart transplant, and then afterwards he starts getting really into heavy metal and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Of course he got the heart from like a 17-year-old guy, you know.
Are you making that up?
No, that's true.
It's the whole thing.
And then there's the guy who, his wife had a heart transplant. And then afterwards, her behaviour in the boudoir changed dramatically, and he said to her, "Oh, you must have got the heart of a whore." She slapped him, but it turned out that he was quite right. She actually got the heart of like an 18-year-old stripper who had been killed in a car crash.
There was another guy who wasn't interested in exercise, and he got the heart of this guy who was a stuntman in Hollywood. And without knowing why, his whole personality changed. He started exercising, doing bicycle racing, and all kinds of weird stuff.
How's this going to impact on the notion of non-self?
Well, exactly. It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, maybe that consciousness is still in their heart. It's been transplanted into that person and blended in with his consciousness.
Yeah.
I think that the body is a conditioned thing, obviously.
Yeah.
And the heart is a conditioned thing. And the heart was conditioned by that person, the things that affected them in their life.
Mm.
And then when the conditions from that are taken and placed in another place,
then
those conditions affect that body and that brain.
Mm.
So
but then we'll also be affected by that in turn, yeah?
That in turn, right. Yeah. So that's pretty...
Yeah.
But that's saying that the heart is everything, you know, because that person took their own heart out, right?
Yeah.
And they put another person's heart in. The only thing they put in from the other person is the heart. So therefore, when the heart contains all this, and the person changes their personality, and history,
they don't change entirely and completely, but their personality changes. But I don't know if their sense of identity changes. Do they still feel like the same person? I think they still feel like the same person. There was another case I had where there was two couples. Sorry?
That woman wouldn't have slapped her husband's face if she'd...
Yeah.
if she'd actually thought of herself as a whole.
Right.
So her sense of who she was had changed.
Yeah, there was another case, very interesting one, where they had what they call a domino transplant. Domino transplant, somebody's heart and lungs pack up, so somebody dies, three people involved, one person dies, they take the heart and lungs out, they then put that heart and lungs into somebody whose lungs have packed up. They then take out their heart and put that in the heart of somebody whose heart has packed up. Okay, so the end result of it is that you have the heart of somebody else who's still alive. Right? So they introduce these two guys and with their wives and chatting, you know, and say, you know, oh, my Fred, you know, he's just completely changed, you know, after, you know, he's become like this. And he said, oh, that's my Harry down to a T, you know. And he's done all of these things. And it was even so specific that one of them had like a pet nickname for his wife that was only like a private name between them that nobody else knew. And of course, the new recipient of the heart then sort of whispered this, said this name to her, you know, when they were in private. And then she said, "Who's that?" You know, bang. And he didn't know where does his name come from. And then they mentioned it. And then that was, of course, the other couple. It was their kind of private name for each other.
There's also an really interesting case. I think you may have told me about. I think it was in Sri Lanka where someone had been brutally murdered, and then a person had a heart transplant, and the heart transplant, after they had the heart transplant, they started to have these kind of like recollections on this murder. And then they told the police about it. And from her, they found who the murderer was.
Wow.
Because she had things come up in her mind.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that. Maybe it was from Ajahn Brahm. I hadn't heard that story.
Yeah.
You heard that from Ajahn Brahm, yeah.
That is amazing.
So
it's like the chemistry is embedded in the heart.
Yeah.
And carries.
Yeah. And it's those things which we traditionally say are heart qualities, you know, like your love of music or these kinds of things. Yeah. Interesting. So
don't get a heart transplant.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, maybe you want to get one. Maybe everyone wants to get Eva's heart.
An arahant.
Can I just finish off this little bit before we have any more questions? Okay, so just the two Samyutta Agama versions, the shortest and simplest ones. The Buddha met the Brahman on the bank of the river. The Brahman asked him about ritual purification, and he answered about the ritual purification, and the reply satisfied the Brahman. The Madhyama Agama, the discourse, and the individual translation add to the above by having the Buddha give an account of mental purification. This account contrasts a host of mental defilements to the development of the Brahma Viharas. After the Buddha presented such a development as an inner bathing superior to ritual bathing of the outer body, he turned to the topic of water purification. The result of the Buddha's presentation in these two discourses was that his Brahman interlocutor became a lay disciple. Okay? So we now have a more developed discourse, and not only that, but a more sort of profound result. It wasn't just satisfied the Brahman, but this is where he actually became a disciple. And notice that in this case, the Madhyama Agama discourse and the individual translation agree. And this is something which I've noticed on a number of occasions, that the individual or loose translations in the Chinese suttas tend to agree with the Madhyama Agama version, which is Sarvasivadin. And I wonder whether it's just a coincidence that many of the individual translations seem to have a Sarvastivadin affiliation. But anyway, that's just by the by. The two remaining versions are the Pali and Ekotara Agama discourses. Compared to the Madhyama Agama discourse and the individual translations, these two versions have a stronger emphasis on the teachings of early Buddhism proper by bringing in the threefold perfect confidence of a stream enterer and the destruction of the influxes. According to their report, the Buddha's exposition after the self-same exchange with the Brahman on water purification resulted in the Brahman going forth and becoming an arahant. Thus, while in the two Samyutta Agama versions the discourse is concerned merely with the inefficacy of water purification, in Madhyama Agama and individual translation the emphasis is on the mental purity of the Brahma Viharas as opposed to mental defilements, and the Pali and the Ekotara Agama representations highlight realization as the proper type of purification. And in each of these three types of presentation, the Brahman's reaction fits well with the depth of the discourse that he received. Okay, so in the simplest discourse, he just said, I'm convinced. And the more developed one, he says, okay, I've gained faith, I've become a lay follower. And the most developed one, that's really talking about eliminating all defilements, these are the ones following which he became an arahant. So this is kind of cohesion. So three groups of texts there.
Yep. Just point out that this Paramahansa is actually not the Buddha's words, because and not the person's words either, because it ends and the speech marks end there, and it's just a thing added on the end.
Which bit is?
The 22.
22. Yeah. Okay.
So it's just the thing that's
tacked on at the end. Yeah.
Tacked on at the end. But also I wanted to bring up about what no long time means.
Ah, yeah, natira seva, in no long time, it's obviously an idiom. I mean, one interesting example of that is in the Ratapala Sutta, where Ratapala went forth and then in no long time became an arahant and then went back to visit his family and they didn't recognize him. Right? So, seems it must have been at least many years before he actually went back, so, yeah.
Also, I wanted to point out with Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, with Bhava as being.
Uh-huh, yep.
So, which you've encountered in number 18,
yep.
And also here in 22.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's right. Bhikkhu Bodhi translated Bhava as being in this particular translation. So in his earliest translations, Bhikkhu Bodhi used existence for Bhava, and then in the Majjhima he used being. And then when he initially translated the Samyutta, he used becoming. So these are the three main renderings of Bhava. Bhikkhu Bodhi used all three of them. So when he was doing the Samyutta, then I had a bit of words to him on this topic. And he said he used Bhava as being in this context out of deference for Venerable Nyanamoli, who used being. And Nyanamoli, in turn, was very much influenced by the existentialist philosophers. And in particular, Martin Heidegger, whose most famous work was on called Being and Time. And Nyanamoli's close friend, of course, was Nyanavira. And they had a kind of long dialogue about many Dhamma topics. And one of the core Dhamma topics that they actually investigated quite a lot was this notion of being and existence of in terms of Buddhism as related to the existentialists. And Nyanavira preferred the works of Heidegger regarding him as the most interesting or most accurate of the existentialist philosophers. And so that not being particularly surprising, since Martin Heidegger was up until the end of his life an unreformed supporter of the Nazis, and Nyanavira and Nyanamoli first encountering Buddhism by a book written by an Italian fascist. And so there is this kind of little connection there, which runs as a sort of dark stream underneath certain of the ways that Buddhism has been interpreted. Yeah, but certainly Nyanavira's character was gave the same kind of impression as some of the existentialists do, kind of quite cynical and dark in terms of his personality. Anyway, so they preferred the word being, and that very much came from that kind of philosophical background. And it was quite, but there's a number of essays by Nyanamoli on the topic, which are very interesting, talking about Bhava and the way that it's used in various contexts. So that was why Bhikkhu Bodhi felt that he had to use that. And he said he got comments from Christians, because he talked about, like, Puna Bhava is like, he translated as renewal of being. So he said that, you know, Christian readers read it and thought that it was talking about like spiritual rebirth, you know, being born again or something like this in the Christian text. So this was why he felt that he wanted to change it. Yeah. So he initially used Samyutta, existence in the Samyutta Agama, but then after I persistently refused to cease nagging him, he eventually changed it to existence. Okay, so we've been having quite a long time for the Sutta class today. So thank you for your patience.
Bhagavantam Abhivade Svakato Bhagavata Namo Dhamman Namasam Supapipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangharam Namo.